Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of the Caribbean, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the Caribbean in the 19th century, as it adapts to an economy no longer dependent upon slavery and responds to the growing regional influence of the United States of America.
In our last programme on the history of the Caribbean, we focused on slavery, which of course is a topic, understandably, that was very important at the time and remains very important in the collective consciousness of the Caribbean, both by its own peoples and indeed more widely. In this programme, we're going to talk about a topic that doesn't tend to engage so much attention, or indeed, it has to be said, unfortunately, interest, and that is the Caribbean in the 19th century, going into the early period of the 20th, after slavery. And what I want to try and do is explain that, in a way, the aftermath of slavery was not the sole narrative. It clearly was important, and it's worth bearing in mind, as I discuss in my book, other people have discussed in their books, that slavery, although the British ended it on the British islands, British colonies, in the 1830s, that did not mean that everybody woke up and said, wait for the British, we're going to do the same. Indeed, the slavery, if anything, was strengthened in the largest island in the Caribbean, which is Cuba, then a Spanish colony until 1898, a Spanish colony, and the sugar industry in Cuba, which essentially relied on slave labour, if anything, benefited from the abolition of slavery on the British islands, because the cost of production rose, the volume of production on the British islands fell, the British became less consequential as a rival. And on top of that, Britain had the largest empire in the world. On top of that, British free trade policies, of course, meant that Spanish sugar ceased to be something that was so discriminated against. It was rather as if there was a sort of precursor as to what was to happen with Britain when it joined the European Economic Community. Now, I think on the one hand, we have to accept that the continuance in some islands, some of slavery, remains an important narrative. In France, for example, the French islands, for example, it ceases as a result of the revolution in 1848 that throws out the monarchy of Louis-Philippe. As I said, in the Spanish islands, it's later. But irrespective of the legal status of slavery, there, of course, is the legacy of slavery in the sense of the often very limited social capital available in the islands. And the argument that this has been a consequence of colonial rule and of slavery, an argument that is used at the present day by those people who press for compensation. I think it's fair to say there is several flaws in this argument. We'll come and discuss it with great length in the next programme. But among the flaws is that the majority of the world in the 1830s, 1840s and 1850s, there was a shortage of what we would call social capital. It was not as though much of the European population in the 1830s or 1840s enjoyed free education. So the absence of that, for example, in colonies is not as remarkable as it might seem from the present situation, etc., etc. What I think is worth saying is, if we start from the British point of view, but we could, in fact, then rapidly add that of the French, that there was a broader current of change of emphasis in empire in this period, in which the Caribbean became less important, irrespective of the abolition of slavery. Now, one argument is to say it became less important because of the abolition of slavery, and that's a point of view you could take, that, for example, the British Islands become less profitable, they in some respects become an incubus of empire, and therefore they attract less attention. And that's a viewpoint you can take. But I think being realistic, a British empire which by 1840 includes Australasia, includes even more of India and South Asia, includes a growing presence in Oceania, and includes Canada, all of which bring economic benefits. And by 1850 and even more 1855, these economic benefits include, for example, Southern Africa is another area, include access to the major bullion supply in gold rushes in the world. It's not surprising that, in a sense, the Caribbean attracts less attention from imperial rulers. And the economic opportunities, the strategic concerns bound up in the other parts of empire, the British, for example, the route to India, the China question, the French and the British competition in Southeast Asia, competition in Africa, the eventual arrival into imperial power politics of both Italy and Germany, and also, in fact, in the case of Congo, Belgium. All of these, the development of the Dutch Empire in the East Indies, all of these put the Caribbean very much in the shadows. And I think it's fair to say that this has got absolutely nothing to do with sugar, the demise of slavery, racism, or anything else. This is to do with the respective power politics and economic benefit of different parts of the world in global trading and political systems, period. The two powers for whom the Caribbean were most consequential were powers that in many senses were regional powers, although they also had a global reach. And those were Spain and the United States. In the case of Spain, the loss of its mainland Latin American colonies in the 18-teens and 1820s, and indeed in the same period, they'd lost the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean, had left Spain essentially as an imperial power with Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and one or two enclaves on the coast of Morocco and what is now area that was the Spanish Sahara, which is variously contested at the present moment. Of those, the area that was economically most significant was Cuba, and it was the focus of Spanish concern. There were attempts to expand in Morocco. They met significant resistance. They were limited in scale, and ultimately they were overshadowed by those of France. There were Spanish activities elsewhere. They briefly took back the Dominican Republic. They had naval operations against Peru in the Pacific. But in essence, Cuba was the center of the Spanish Empire. And its pection and the fate of Cuba was very, very important to Spain as an imperial power. That did not mean, though, that with the exception of the brief return to power in the Dominican Republic, that did not mean that Spain was otherwise seeking to expand in the Caribbean. And indeed, what is striking in Caribbean power politics is that the distribution of control that had arisen as a result of the Napoleonic Wars, when Britain had taken, for example, Trinidad from Spain, that division of control essentially is sustained in the islands thereafter. And indeed, the only major changes is in our long 19th century is the Spanish loss of Cuba and Puerto Rico, and then the sale by Denmark of the Virgin Islands to the United States. So Spain is number one. The other power, the crucial power, and this goes back very much to our first program in which we discussed the need with the Caribbean to think of the coastal areas, is the United States. The United States at the beginning of the 19th century was not a Caribbean power. The northern seaboard of the United States belonged If you look at the period from 1763 onwards, well, prior to 1763 as well, it belonged to either Spain or France or Britain, and the colonies, particularly the colonies of East Florida, West Florida — West Florida is the panhandle — and Louisiana moved between them. It was only the United States' success in purchasing Louisiana from France in 1803 and in conquering and intimidating Spain into ceding first West Florida and then East Florida that meant that most of the seaboard of the Northern Caribbean came under American control. And that was furthered when Texas became an independent state, fought and defeated the Mexicans, and then eventually joined the Union, so that the American border reached to the border with Mexico. Now, this is and was an enormously important series of events for Caribbean history. And if you wanted to be provocative — and there's nothing wrong with being provocative, as long as one understands that it's in order to get people to think about things, not in order to suggest any respective moral significance — you could argue that the extension of American power was more significant than the abolition of slavery. That would probably cause a lot of upset, but it's worth thinking about that. One can take that forward, though, to note that far from being an inconsequential part of America, as, for example, Alaska largely was when it was purchased from Russia in 1867, the seaboard on the Caribbean was particularly important because New Orleans was the great entrepot into the wider Mississippi Basin. The wider Mississippi Basin, linked by steamer services on the river and on its tributaries, such as the Missouri, actually sort of supplied the growing part of America onto the west of the Appalachians. So I think it's fair to say that although parts of the new America, for example, southern Florida at that period, were relatively little of importance, either economically or politically, that was not true of other sections. And places like Mobile in Alabama, places like New Orleans, were some of the fastest growing and most economically consequential parts of the South. Indeed, when the American Civil War broke out in 1861, New Orleans was the largest city by population terms in the South, and its capture soon after by Union amphibious forces was a very important event in the American Civil War. Now, if we wind back, we can see that the expansion of the United States territorially in the region ceases. Indeed, in terms of contiguous coastline, the continental United States does not expand against Mexico after the peace settlement in 1848 brings to an end the Mexican-American War of 46 to 48. There's subsequently the purchase of some land further west, the Gadsden Purchase of 1853, to ease rail routes towards San Diego, but that is nothing to do with the coastline on the Caribbean. And that's a point worth making, and indeed it's a point worth making that the Americans, although they have one or two claims to minor islands, the Americans don't really do anything of enormous consequence in the Caribbean thereafter until 1898. However, that was not clear to contemporaries earlier on. Indeed, what surprised many of them was that American ambitions for territorial expansion in the Caribbean area did not come to fruition earlier. Those who were called in America filibusters — these days that's a term used to denote people who speak for long periods of time in Congress in order to talk out opposing policy changes. In the period we're talking about, a filibuster was somebody who intended by force to seize territory. And there were a number of filibusters who had great ambitions, both for Cuba in particular, Senator Quitman, for example, but also for Central America, of which the most prominent was a man called William Walker, who took over briefly Nicaragua. And on top of that, there were American entrepreneurs like Walker's eventual nemesis, or one of his nemesis, Cornelius Vanderbilt, who wanted to build a canal across Nicaragua. So to a considerable extent, if you're thinking of the United States as the nearest major source of liquidity, the nearest major source of autonomous, potential autonomous political action, a not anywhere near as militarily powerful as Britain, but on the other hand, not having Britain's global distractions in that period. So that in the end, it was a British warship that handed over Walker to, I think I'm right in saying, the government of Honduras, which shot him, may have been Nicaragua, but I think it was Honduras. The reality is that America was already a key political player there. And I think it's fair to say that if it wasn't for the role of imperial power in the point, particularly of Britain, many of these territories in the Caribbean may well have actually been brought under effective American control, if not outright control, particularly possibly the Bahamas. And indeed, it was ultimately the British who lent in mid-century on the Americans not to try and give effect to their plans at that stage to seize Cuba. The British had hoped, British diplomats and some British politicians had hoped to keep Texas independent of the United States. That didn't succeed. They had hoped that Mexico would not be defeated or humiliated by the Americans. They were interested in the notion of a balance of power in the Western Hemisphere. That failed. The war that broke out in 1846 was a defeat for British interests. The British did in the 1850s, in the Bay Islands, in the Western Caribbean, in the coast or the Mosquito Coast of Nicaragua, they did oppose American expansionism, and there were, in fact, violent actions by American military units against British settlements like Greytown on the Mosquito Coast. And the British, you could argue, it has been argued by at least one historian, in effect appeased the Americans. If you take that viewpoint and that it was appeasement, you could say it was probably a sensible prioritization of the many commitments facing British power, and that any imperial power has to decide and determine what was worth fighting for. You could argue that it wasn't in British interests to see Cuba eventually brought under American suasion in 1898. You can take these in different ways. But the point of the matter was that America was the great power in that region increasingly, but that its possibility for exerting its influence on the Caribbean islands was lessened by that of the imperial power of Britain. One or two other points before we throw this open a bit more. An island I haven't mentioned so far, we talked about it last time, was Haiti. Haiti had become formally independent in 1804. It was the only native slave society that was independent. It wasn't much of an advert for it. Now, there are different ways of looking at this. You could argue fairly that the pressure brought by France to pay compensation, reparations to former plantation owners, etc., etc., was an enormous incubus for Haiti, and that is true. But the reality was it was a kleptocracy. The reality was it was a bitterly divided society on geographical and social grounds in particular, where the norm as a means of exercising politics was to kill your political rivals, and where there were a whole series of short-term regimes for much of the early and middle 19th century, with just about every leader called general. And I think so that, you know, power literally did come out of the barrel of a musket. And Haiti, I think it's fair to say, would be regarded or should be regarded as a political disaster. And again, this is probably not a popular thing to say, but it is worth saying that if you would have had the choice as a educated, free black person, ex-slave, you would have been far better off in a British or French colony, despite the brutal British suppression of opposition in Jamaica in 1865 in the Morant Bay uprising, but you would be better off than living in Haiti and having independence, but a lot of other problems. And you could argue the same parallel could be seen today if you look at Haiti today. So that's a problematic view. Many people won't be pleased to hear that view announced, but it's worth saying. Lastly, we haven't talked about the southern shores of the Caribbean. The principal power there was Venezuela, which had become independent with the end of Spanish rule. Initially, there was a larger state comprised of Venezuela, of what is now Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador. This fell apart. The only real states in Latin America that actually sustained their territorial identity were the former former Spanish colony of Chile and the former Portuguese colony of Brazil. Everything else had partitions and disruptions. And Colombia itself was subsequently to lose Panama to an American-backed separatist movement designed to achieve, from the American point of view, placid outcome to the politics surrounding the Panama Canal. Venezuela itself also, like Haiti, not to the same scale as Haiti, which was very much unique to itself, but Venezuela also had disrupted politics. It found, like many of the states that had become independent, Mexico is a good example, of course, it found that having resources did not mean that necessarily that there was political stability. And in the 1890s, 1900s, this was exacerbated and accentuated by great power intervention, Germany in particular in the Venezuela question. And that helps to agitate America and actually briefly returns the Caribbean to broader concerns from the perspective of international attention. One last point that's worth bearing in mind. Both Mexico and the United States have civil wars in the 1860s. They're too often treated separately, which is a mistake, because actually comparisons and contrasts are instructive. But one major difference is that in the case of Mexico, there is international intervention, initially by Spain, Britain, and France in 1861, but the British and the Spaniards pull out and it becomes just by Napoleon III of France. And that does indicate the possibility that the Western Caribbean could have gone in a very different direction to the way it does go. But as you may know, the French military intervention comes to an end in 1867. As a reminder of the difficulties of judging events and the way in which you should always be wary of historians and others who offer you a single interpretation, they're generally fools, if not worse. You could argue that the French presence comes to an end because of the strength and endurance of Mexican resistance. You could argue it comes to an end because of the threat of American intervention after the American Civil Wars come to an end in 1865. Now there is the possibility of America deploying troops against the Emperor Maximilian, France's candidate, on whom there's incidentally a good recent biography, Shawcross, Or you could say, well, Napoleon III was more concerned by the aftermath of the Prussian victory over Austria in 1866 and the need to focus his military attention on Europe. And probably all three are significant factors, but probably the last is the most important one. But people obviously don't like thinking that the topic that they work on, Mexico or the New World, is subordinate to something else. Again, we go back to this issue of prioritization. Now, the contrast with the American Civil War is very instructive. In the American Civil War, although Napoleon III wished to intervene on behalf of the Confederacy, part and parcel of his idea of a kind of new order in which the Confederacy and Mexico would both be allied states of France, helping France to become more powerful, being economic and political partners, and also being conservative forces. Napoleon III, by the time he was an emperor, as opposed to by the time when he was an earlier a president of the Second Republic, saw himself as a conservative. British politicians, some of them thought in the same direction, but ultimately Napoleon III wouldn't move without the British, and the British decided that they didn't wish to move, again, for a number of reasons, which I've discussed in my book, Struggle for Mastery in North America. But the net effect was that there is not an independent Confederacy. It is worth considering what the history of the Caribbean might have been had there been an independent Confederacy, and in particular, if that independent Confederacy had maintained slavery and had been allied to a Spanish-ruled Cuba, which was maintaining slavery, and also allied to a Mexico under Napoleon III. And in case this all seems ludicrously counterfactual or what if of history, these were entirely and exactly topics that were extensively discussed in this period. But by the end of 1865, in the case of the United States, the Confederacy has failed. There are Northern troops in occupation in the South. One of the states in which they remain longest is, in fact, Louisiana, where there is high levels of violence, internal violence, particularly in 67, 68, but not only then. Black militia on the streets of New Orleans fighting white racists, etc., etc. Carpetbaggers, all the works. And again, there are all sorts of possibilities of developments. If you wish to go for a different counterfactual, you could assume a continuance of a counterfactual of a Democrat, in the sense of Democratic, not in the sense of the Democrat Party, which had been the party most closely aligned with the South, but a Democratic political movement with representation to a great extent by American Black people, are looking to the Republican Party at the national level and possibly aligning with anti-colonial or Black movements in the Caribbean. Again, that's a counterfactual. Again, that came to an end. The pulling out of federal troops from the South by Rutherford P. Hayes in 1877 in order to, as a political bargain and in order to secure his election, was in practical terms a response to the political realities on the ground, to the small size of federal forces, to the need that was felt to have some sort of reconciliation with Southern whites, however morally you might or might not find that distasteful. And what that did was produce from a different direction, a stasis as opposed to a radicalism. It's different too, but nevertheless also radical, the idea, as I've earlier enunciated, of a white supremacist regime retaining control. So what one's got in the Caribbean by the 1870s, even more 1880s and 1890s, is a growingly dominant United States in terms of its economic power, in terms of its population growth. The principal place, for example, for British emigrants to go were not any of the British colonies, but in fact the United States. So you've got enormous emigration. You've got the great growth of New Orleans, the most dynamic and prosperous of the Caribbean cities. You've got the autonomy of the and independence of the former Spanish states. You've got a continuation of imperial rule on the islands in the Caribbean, with the exclusion of failed Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which is more successful, but also has a hell of a lot of problems. And that's where I think we are at on the eve of America going to war with Spain in 1898.
Well, Professor Black, a huge number of threads there in your introduction. And I want to just try and pick or tease just one or two of them. I want to start with this theme of growing American, growing United States influence in the region. How significant was James Monroe's proclamation, that the so-called Monroe Doctrine of 1823, in practice as distinct from in principle?
A very good distinction that you've made there. In practice, not of great consequence. It actually obviously enunciates a view which is a fairly obvious view for American politicians, the idea that the Americas should in some way be separate. It was to be given a bit more substance subsequently by politicians like Henry Clay, who negotiate treaties with Latin American states. But the reality is that for reasons of liquidity, investment, Britain is much more consequential, say in Mexico, though France is also important there, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Cuba, and it's a Spanish colony. And I think it's fair to say that the America does not and cannot perform as a great power militarily in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, because the nature of the American federal system and the strength of anti-central government ideology is that there is a very weak army, there's a fairly weak navy. The navy, as with Willis's expedition to the Pacific or Perry to Japan, is capable of significant acts, but the practicality is that America at that period is most effective in fighting Mexico and would have found it considerably harder to have achieved that sort of outcome if they'd been at war with, say, Britain.
I want to tie this in also with trade policy as well, and just to tease out to what extent American economic interests can muscle into the Caribbean. And I appreciate the answer is difficult because different islands are owned by different, Haiti aside, are owned by different European powers and with different economic policies and different legal structures. But generally, in thinking particularly of British possessions like Jamaica, was it easy for American business interests to buy up property and establish trade, or were there a lot of inhibitions in the way that kept these different parts of the Caribbean pretty much in the economic sphere of the European colonizing power?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there are three main zones in the Caribbean for American investment. Number one, the prime zone, America. And remember, from the point of view of, let's say, Boston banking interests, Pensacola in West Florida or Galveston are foreign territory in many respects. You know, there are different cultures down there. But number one is America. Number two, independent states. The Latin American states become major sources of raw materials, in particular to the United States, things like coffee, sugar, so that's number two. Number three would be European colonies. And yes, there are problems in terms of, as you put it, inhibitions, protectionism. But the actual other problems would be that in terms of markets to export to, these are relatively small markets in population terms and markets that have relatively low liquidity. And in terms of importing from them, they don't really sell an enormous amount that is useful to the Americans. If you want to buy sugar, you're better off buying it from Cuba than from one of the British colonies. But from Cuba, you've got the problems of warfare there. You've got the also the effect that you can actually buy a lot of the West Indian goods from Louisiana itself. So that's an issue. So there are practical, as there are today, you know, it is not, you know, these countries are independent now. There are very few limitations on American trade with, shall we say, former British colonies. But the reality is those colonies are not producing an enormous amount that is useful. During the Cold War, the Caribbean was important for producing bauxite, you know, which went into aluminium, obviously very important for the manufacture of aircraft. And there were important sources of petroleum, of oil, particularly Trinidad. But, you know, a lot of these islands are not producing an enormous amount, and their major earnings are from remittances, in other words, people emigrating. And the other major source is tourism today. Well, tourism was not a mass source of income in the 19th century. A lot of the islands in the 19th century found there was population growth without work. And what that did was mean that one of their principal exports was people. Now, obviously, racism limited the movement of people into the United States. But practical, it wasn't just racism. There were practical existing network structures which helped to ensure that immigrants from, say, Ireland or Poland or Italy found it easier. What you get is a significant number, as I discuss in my book, of immigrants from the West Indies going as remittance labor to, for example, develop the Panama Canal or to develop the Venezuelan oil industry. They are often not terribly well treated. The Panama Canal, who overwhelmingly came from the British West Indies, they had high death rates from disease. But you get this in other respects, for example, from the Dominican Republic, people emigrate either permanently or more commonly seasonally to work in the Haitian sugar industry. And a lot of them get killed in, I think it's about 36, 37, it's in my book, when the Haitian regime turns against them. So there's a lot of migrant flow seeking work. This is not the best basis for paying for expensive American-produced goods.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said in your the earlier part of your introduction that relative to other parts of the world, the Caribbean becomes a relatively speaking a less significant strategic priority for the interested European powers. Did that lead to a form of benign or even very far from benign neglect? Would that be putting it too strongly? Is it, you know, when we have particular crises like the Morant Bay Rebellion, is that a product of neglect or of something else?
Well, I think there's certainly neglect. I mean, I think the neglect is of multiple factors, and the economics is one. I mean, we've already mentioned sugar, but of course, it's worth bearing in mind that sugar cane production is being affected by the rise of sugar beet, which becomes important, developed in Germany and copied by Napoleon and also by Russia. So by 1880, more than 50% of the world's sugar is coming from sugar beet. So that's an enormous problem. I think, yes, neglect, I would say, is a factor. I think also it's worth bearing in mind that different empires have different structures. The British Empire, despite the emphasis that is you get these days, I see there's a ludicrous book by Elkins just come out arguing that empire was based on force. In practical terms, empire was based on negotiation with those of local power and influence. So, you know, if you're looking at places like Nigeria or India or Southern Africa or Malaysia, the British Empire is, as it were, a shared product and project. I'm not saying that sharing's on the equal basis, but that's what it is. Now, one of the difficulties in the West Indies is there's nobody really to share it with. The white settler classes of diminished consequence, in part because of the decline of the sugar economy, in part, no doubt, because of the end of slavery, but they're of, you know, reduced significance. And there aren't new lands for them, as it were. And there's nobody else to really share the power with. So in some respects, these are, if one wants to use the concept, under-governed or under-ruled territories, both by whatever you might mean by British imperial authority and by whatever you might mean by local authority, whether white or non-white. Now, some of the whites, maybe a lot of the whites, are racists, which doesn't help matters at all. But there isn't, and, you know, partly this is the legacy of where we've come from. Partly it's the nature of the slowness of the development of a black middle class, the limitations of the numbers of free blacks that had existed. There had been free blacks, but the limitations of the numbers that had existed in the 18th century, these are all factors. And yes, government only has so much time and attention. And I'm not saying that government policy would necessarily have been better, whatever we mean by better, if there'd been a bigger colonial system. But the fact of the matter is the British Empire is governed by singularly few people. And that, I think, affects the nature of its rule and can mean that, like any other imperial system in these contexts, it can use, often in a very flawed, cruel, and unnecessary fashion, acts of sporadic violence in order to try and deal with its own sense of weakness and in order to make what it considers a point. You could see Morant Bay in that context. You can see the Amritsar massacre in 1919 in that context. The interesting thing is, and this is in total contrast with Elkins's real new book, that actually these are pretty exceptional events in imperial history once the colonies have been seized.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will pick up the story in the next episode, taking the history of the Caribbean from the period of the American-Spanish War of 1898 through the 20th century, independence and beyond. But for taking us through the 19th century in the Caribbean, Professor Jeremy Black, whose book, A Brief History of the Caribbean, is out now in paperback. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.